welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we simplify the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores. We are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, trains and transit, and simpler living. And today, surviving on your wits.
That's right.
Out in the woods.
Tracking. Yeah. Which, it's embarrassing, actually, how long it took me to realize that Trackers Northwest, like, they're one of their things they do is actually tracking animals.
Oh, really? Like, that took you a while to...
I thought it was, like, metaphoric or something.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I thought it was Snoopy Camp.
which, to my chagrin, you will hear, listeners, is very different. Yes.
Tony's not into Snoopy Camp.
Not at all.
So, yeah. Happy weekend, sir. Happy new week.
Yeah.
I am lying in bed at night dreaming of bicycle touring. It's so close, I can taste it.
I don't remember my dreams.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. Did I tell you about my dream journal?
No.
Yeah.
You keep a dream journal?
Well, it's kind of fallen off the past couple of days.
Wait, is this something we should be broadcasting?
Oh, sure. Okay. I don't give a shit. If someone knows, maybe it's kind of weird. Maybe it's kind of dorky. But I don't think I'm hippy-dippy about it. Okay. What I've found is if I write down my dreams when I wake up, they make way more sense to me after I write them down. Like, if I dream of a large ball of wax rolling, you know, from one end of town to another, and I'm inside the ball of wax, and I see a derailleur crushed on the side of the road as I roll past, and then I wake up I'm waking from a dream into another dream.
Right.
And then my mom is telling me that, like, it's time to go to school, but I'm 28. You know, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
All of these things, they don't make any sense.
Right.
But I find that when I write them down, usually the things I'm dreaming about have something to do with thoughts I had the previous day.
I see.
And so
you don't spend the rest of the morning going, like, what does it mean?
Yeah, what the fuck was that? Exactly. And actually, I did have one of those the other day, which I probably won't go into detail about, but it was one of those just like, that was the weirdest thing I've ever dreamed about, bar none. And yeah, but I think, like, just the act of cognition and putting it down to paper is something that makes everything kind of come together in a way.
Right.
Like, I see the reasons for the dream. Even the dream itself is still like gibberish and doesn't make sense. The reason that I had that dream is because I was thinking about something or other the day before.
Ah,
so
okay.
It demystifies the whole thing.
Sure, sure.
Simplifying the good life.
Within your own subconscious, even.
As we do. So are you ready to bicycle tour, sir?
Am I ready? Mentally, yes. I have been wanting to do this for a long ass time.
Yeah, it's going to feel good.
Yeah.
Get out and back on the road.
I cannot wait to just... Yeah, get on the bike and go.
Yeah, and we did the camping trip over the weekend in January, and I think I was talking about it with friends last night as I watched famous people congratulate themselves. Or congratulate each other at the Oscars.
I forgot that was last night.
Yeah, yeah.
I missed it completely.
I've never watched the Oscars. I don't feel any good big reason to watch them again, I guess. I guess it's just weird.
At my height of trying.
It would be like going to someone else's union meeting.
That's a pretty good analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. At my height of trying socially,
you mean
I hosted. I didn't go to. I didn't attend. I hosted an Oscar party.
And traditionally, are you into the Oscars?
Fuck no.
Okay, so this was the height of
a bunch of famous people like pretending like their job actually like is meaningful.
Right. Right.
I love movies as much as the next.
They're
person,
entertaining,
but they're movies. They're entertainment, and
right.
You know, the Nobel Prizes are. I'm kind of going off the rails here. I know, but the Nobel Prizes are bad enough.
Sure,
it's just big like scientific circle jerk.
But at least that has something to do with.
But these people for the most part have done something, have contributed something to the world,
to the mechanism of society,
and
yeah.
Again, I love movies. I love creativity. But the Oscars...
They're inside baseball is what they are.
Yeah. And it's just, you're great. No, you're great. No, you're great. Yeah, I'm great. Yes,
right.
I'm great too.
Exactly.
We're all great.
Although McConaughey did get to say, all right, all right, all right. And he also started
his
speech.
He's like all emaciated and shit now.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He's glowing and tan. He started his speech saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, which made me laugh. It was like a, you know, kind of a, but the reason I don't even know why we're talking about the Oscars. When I was hanging out with people at the Oscars party last night,
yes,
I mentioned that we had gone camping recently, and January is the last time I went camping. You and I, it was like 6 weeks ago.
Wait,
or
there
something.
There was an Oscars party last night you went to?
It was just a couple of friends. Yeah, it was Adele and a couple of her old housemates, and I was the only boy, which made it, you know, I guess I get along all right with women. Works out okay. I was afraid that I was a little bit too sarcastic for the whole event, that like I wasn't right. taking it as seriously as they were.
Right.
So I hope I didn't hurt anybody's feelings. Oh. But yeah. But if I hurt somebody's feelings,
you can always apologize later.
Well, yeah, and if I hurt their feelings up with my opinions about Hollywood, then that's a fairly shallow hurting of feelings, unless
that's
they take it very deeply.
That's true.
Yeah.
I worked on that film.
And they didn't. Right. But it was really nice to go camping a month ago, and I didn't realize it's been that long. And now it's only about 3 weeks until we board a train heading south to go
and
to San Francisco.
Go camping for several nights.
Seriously. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think this is cool. And we'll get to, I guess we'll get to some mail. But I heard from a listener who said, hey, I am down in Santa Cruz. You should swing by and say hello when you come through town. So we might do that.
I think we should.
Yeah. That's a new sustaining donor, Roger. And then let's see what else. We're going to, San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Half Moon Bay. Santa Cruz, Monterey.
Is there still plans on visiting Zeitgeist? Or
Zeitgeist is like the bicycle themed bar or something in
right.
San Francisco. Yeah, we should
right.
get a, we should get like a noonday pint there, or something.
Well
I mean,
get a noonday
yeah.
pint.
You won't be having one. You'll be having a noonday soda,
that's
which
right.
is fine. And let's see what else. Monterey, Big Sur, which I think we're planning on trying to like get out and hike around in a little bit.
Yeah. As Adele informs me today.
Yes. Oh, by the
we're
way.
We're going to get off our bikes. For
once you're tired of, yeah, once you're thoroughly exhausted from your bicycling. Yeah. Which makes me a little bit nervous too, because I remember every year when I go on a big tour,
yeah,
I kind of break myself in on the tour. Like I traditionally don't train a lot, and I'm trying to get better about that, trying to go out and exercise, and I've started running and all that. But,
sure.
But yeah, inevitably, we do not cycle 60 miles in a day with touring gear strapped to the bike. And so, yeah, I'm hoping, you know, I want to take it easy, which
right,
is why we'll
right.
probably start using transit to get out of San Francisco. One, because I've heard
yeah.
terrible things about Devil's Slide.
Right. You were talking about that
yeah.
Friday night.
Big yeah. Mountain Pass.
Was it Friday?
I think so.
Saturday night.
Saturday. It all bleeds together for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also because Half Moon Bay to Santa Cruz, you could ride from San Francisco. From Old Frisco to Santa Cruz, but it would be maybe slightly more than we should do on day one, I think. So,
right.
And we're big fans of transit here.
And yeah.
So, yeah.
And I'm thinking about, you know, trying to do the ride out to Crater Lake on our first leg and just getting stuck in, you know, the... What is it? Was it Oregon City that we were stuck in for a long time?
Oh, right. Yeah, like trying to get from Portland. So this
we
was
were
when
just
we
just like in
yeah,
subdivision hell.
See episode 46 or 47, I think. This was you and I and Adele as part of Team Sincerity leaving Portland, heading south to go to Crater Lake. And yeah, Oregon City, if you don't have a map, can be confusing and steep. So yeah. And then we're also going to Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo. So if any of you listening are out in those areas or will be near those areas, let us know. We will try and get in touch, say hello. If you have a yard we can camp in that is near any part of our route, you know, we may or may not need
or
a place
even,
to stay.
Yeah, or even just hints as to
or if you know of a vacant lot somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, between boarded up buildings. We'll just sneak back there. Bonus points if you know of a burn barrel. So, yeah.
We'll need at least two more guys to sing some doo-wop around the burn barrel.
Exactly. Yeah. A little bit of a cappella.
That's right.
I'll sing bass if Mama sings tenor. And the rest will just follow along. Something like that.
That's a Johnny Cash reference.
He might have sung that song. I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm not even particularly partial to that song, so I'm not sure why I brought it up.
I don't know either.
Yeah. You did a ride up Tabor today, right?
I did.
Yeah, how
I
did that go?
Three times up Tabor.
That's three times.
Yeah.
So one would be out of necessity, possibly. Two.
Kind of, yeah, to to get here, I guess.
The second set of training, the third's out of masochism.
Easily. Yeah. But yeah, the second and third is just, I hate me. I hate me. Do it again, you dumb shit. Well, okay, I'll do it.
I'm proud of you, sir, because I took the bus to work this morning.
Oh, you did?
You know why?
Why?
Because it was raining.
Yeah, it was pretty bad this morning.
It sounded bad, and it was before the sun came up, and I had a big weekend. I didn't feel like riding my bike to work at all.
Well, to be fair, the sun didn't show itself till about 1 o'clock today.
Yeah, but then it burst out, and it was glorious, so I rode home.
Beautiful.
I got about half of my workout.
Ah, well, there you go.
So half a workout, let's see, that's like an hour, so I just need to do that 6 times every day for a week, and we'll make our tour happen.
There you go.
All right. Good framing,
here's
good
the thing.
Context.
Well, here's the thing about training. I am philosophically adverse to training as a thing.
Uh-huh. Did you like the movie with Denzel Washington?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because King Kong ain't got shit on me.
Okay, perfect.
Yes. Where was I with this? Yeah, so training. I get sidetracked so easily these days.
That's why we're here. You're here to talk, I'm here to talk, and both of us are also here to derail each other.
All right, no. Great. So, yeah, so training. I don't know. For me, if you want to, like, do a long tour or whatever, just try to stay in shape to do that tour. You know?
As opposed to having to ramp up your fitness?
Right. Yeah. As opposed to... You know, oh shit, I gotta ride 60-mile days for the next week in order to be able to ride 60-mile days for the next week.
Yeah.
You know, there's something in that implies that, you know, you've kind of let yourself go.
I suppose, yeah. And so letting yourself go, that's a bad idea.
That is a very bad idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Always, okay. Always keep trying. Always, you know. Do one more lap up Mount Tabor.
Yeah, yeah. Good call. Well, hey, speaking of, I was going to say speaking of masochism, but that's a terrible segue. We had a really interesting...
Trackers Northwest. Ding.
Related to nothing we're talking about now. We had a fantastic conversation with Tony Dice from Trackers Earth. And
it's Trackers Earth now.
Yeah,
it
was Trackers Northwest when I heard about it, and they are rebranding.
And they're still, if you were to Google Trackers Northwest, you'll get there.
Oh, you'd find them. Know, yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
And I'm trying to remember. It's in the conversation there.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, a fabulous conversation about kind of the state of the world, the state of people and children growing up without access to the outdoors, lost skills or the potential to lose skills. And a lot of things that I didn't think would actually tie into bicycling as much as they did. We had a great conversation that kind of wrapped it all up into a package and made it relevant for you that are maybe complaining about, no, they don't talk about bikes enough. So, yeah.
If we're not talking about bikes enough.
That's my generic cynic voice.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not anybody in particular. Unless that actually sounds like you, and then I apologize.
In my head, I think we talk about bikes too much sometimes.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe so.
That's for another day.
Well, let's go to the interview, and then we'll be back on the other side with mail and news. Thanks for coming over. Good to see you.
Oh, yeah. Surprise day off for me.
Seriously, congratulations.
Yeah. It's nice to have.
I just realized I have again forgot to ask for pronunciation, so I should do that before I introduce you. Is it Deus?
It's Dice, actually. Dice. It's the German spelling version.
Okay. Tony Dice. So in that case, we can say, hello, Tony Dice. Thank you for joining us.
Excellent. Thank you, Brock. I appreciate being here.
Yeah. And Aaron, on your unexpected day off, hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So tell us about Trackers. How long has it been together?
We're actually about to hit our 10-year anniversary. So we started in 2004, and Trackers came out of the inspiration I had and several other people had. We were working in outdoor education, working at camps, working with adults and adult training teaching programs, teaching a lot of wilderness survival skills, outdoor skills, bushcraft, what we always referred to as old school outdoor skills. And a lot of programs we worked for, that wasn't their focus. You know, their focus was a different type of outdoor education. As we came to refer to them, we called them Snoopy Camp. Or it's about gluing macaroni on a plate, you know. Or, you know, probably better off was some of the more academic-centered focus for environmental or outdoor education. And we wanted to harken back to old-school skills and skills that made people self-reliant, self-sufficient, resilient in the communities they were living. And so that was our goal with Trackers, and we realized we had to kind of spin off and do our own thing in order to make that happen.
Okay. And have you been with it since the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay.
Since the get-go.
There we go.
One of the founders. I'll either be proud to say that, or sometimes, you know, I'll hang my head in wonderment. I don't know what that means.
There are many things I'm sure you could wonder at. But these are skills. You say bushcraft. That's a word that I'm not necessarily familiar with. I have an idea of what it means, but how would you define it?
You know, we're kind of dancing around a central thing here that's harder to articulate in the language we have today. Bushcraft is actually a term that I hear more often used in Europe. You know, when I say wilderness survival skills, people click with it a little bit more. When we say, you know, earth living skills, we're talking about talking to the inner hippie in all of us, right? But really, it's about traditional skills or skills that have been innate to human beings since human beings were human beings, and maybe even a little bit before then. And it's not so much any one particular skill set, but it's about connecting to the land through your livelihood. Or making your livelihood with the land, you know, in concert with it, in familiarity with it.
Okay, that makes some sense, I think.
Yeah, I wish I could actually just erase a lot of those terms and kind of like start from scratch there. But you know, in order to talk with people, we begin with what their first inclinations or ideas are of it.
Okay, yeah, it's the sort of thing that it would seem like it's common sense, but it's also something that's a little bit. Lacking, or like we don't have good ways to learn those skills today necessarily, which is why there's a nonprofit that exists to do this. So just in the state of today's current education, like, is this, do you see a way that this might someday become back, or is Trackers foundational to these skills surviving for a lot of people?
I don't think we're the only ones out there. There's a lot of really good people that actually, you know, either practice on their own or practice in community. And it's a diversity of skill sets. You know, I mean, you got to say how relevant to connecting to the land is blacksmithing, but we do blacksmithing in our programs, right?
Right,
I mean, that becomes a little bit more about, you know, making and connecting to what, you know, the tools you use and being more of that maker culture. That said, you know, I think at the heart of what we do, it is focused on land-based, you know, skill sets, and it's focused on actually gathering your food, actually growing your food, actually having an almost family or familiar relationship with what allows you to survive and live. We're all not going to make it, you know, 110% on that level. You know, we're not going to recluse ourselves out into the woods and become that monk doing that. You know, we all have jobs. I drove into town today in order to go to that job and then also do an interview with you guys. Yet at the same time, we know that that capability is there, that it exists, and it's well practiced enough. And, you know, so I can live my life whether or not the apocalypse happens. But if it does, I have some, you know, certain values that remain and hold true during it.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the apocalypse, we think about this, I think, maybe a fair amount as...
It seems to come up a lot.
Yeah. And it's not... I wouldn't,
fun.
In the recent years. Oh, yeah. It's great to think about.
I was
going
to say we don't fetishize the apocalypse, but maybe we do in a certain way. It's just the idea that, like... That shit could hit the fan at any point, and if we know how to use the land, if we know how to work with the earth, then that doesn't have to be as bad of a thing as if we're stranded without all of our devices that do all of our work for us.
Yeah, well, I wonder if it comes from this sort of subconscious or unconscious desire to sort of live more simply or live with the land or survive, quote-unquote, on your wits, that we don't. We don't really feed that desire here in urban America. And I wonder if like our imaginings or our imagination like sort of brings up this apocalyptic scenario in order to sort of vicariously live through the or live out those desires.
It's a form of role playing. In fact, we actually akin trackers to like live action role playing.
Okay.
You know, and while you live through that wish fulfillment, so to speak, you are learning something about relationships, and you're learning something about things that we forget, you know, that our current culture forces us to forget, you know, the pell-mell that we actually all live through. And, you know, I go back to why it's so prevalent right now in children's literature, right? You know, we don't give our kids an opportunity to experience self-reliance and responsibility and accountability. And in some ways, you know, it holds out the potential that you are more connected to community. In fact, you look at a lot of disasters that have happened over the years, and everyone thinks that, you know, anarchy is going to break loose, but actually people simply are guided more to help each other out, help their neighbors out.
Right.
In those incidences. And so I think that we see that potential beyond the disparity and the kind of fissuring in our current culture, fissuring from what, you know, we live from, our food, you know, fissuring from our relationships, from our families. And we see that as a, you know, kind of fantastical world that could exist. And honestly, if, you know, something did ever happen, if we ever did have a breakdown of that culture, it wouldn't be pleasant. It would be pretty horrific and awful. That role playing still is useful to help us remember the things that we've forgotten, that we have left behind, on for more local livelihood and living.
Yeah.
In fact, I just we're in the process of publishing, and it should be ready by summer, a 400-page novel that's a middle school, kind of in the cusp of like a middle school book novel, about Portland post-apocalypse.
Really?
100 years after the apocalypse. It's called Tales of Cascadia.
Interesting.
And, you know, it's based on a lot of the skills we teach, and it has it's both a skills learning book and also, you know, a narrative of a story. And, you know, for us, when we share that story with kids or kids have read it, you know, they're automatically compelled and interested because that's the world they want to live in, because school sucks. And I'll be frank.
Right. It's not usually any fun.
No, it's not any fun. It's not compelling to them. It's not about, you know, building a more self-reliant human being or a human being that contributes to their community. School's about fissuring, getting a career, being successful, and learning to the test.
Sorry, I got a little bit of technical failure.
Speaking of self-reliance, we cannot rely on our equipment, apparently.
Or my helmet balancing on my bags.
There we go. Easy enough.
It's like the built-in Foley group.
We've got all of our sound effects being generated for us.
All right.
Sweet.
So beyond the apocalypse here,
we got to that really quickly.
Let's get beyond the thunder.
We will have to figure out a way to like ship coffee in via the apocalypse. Make sure it's fair trade too.
Oh yeah,
so somebody's got to learn to sail.
That's right. Yes. Well, and speaking of this, is it three guilds?
Four guilds. You know, like I said, Trackers is a role-playing game, right?
Okay.
Role-playing game with intrinsic value, you know, role-playing game that's designed to connect people more to their community and their family. And our four guilds are the Rangers, Wilders, Mariners, and Artisans Guild.
Okay, because I remember the Mariners Guild. That's why I was thinking of shipping coffee and why it connected to what you were saying.
They exist explicitly.
Okay, there we go.
No, not really, but yeah. And the Rangers Guild is focused more on those wilderness survival, those kind of primary skills, those first skills. The Wilders Guild is focused more on homesteading, but also long-term sustainability, you know. And so they look at the land and say, you know, how do we restore it? How do we actually increase its carrying capacity? How do we, you know, have this land so it can actually support a community? And how do we support the land as a community? The Mariners Guild is interesting because, yeah, I think that in a lot of outdoor education and a lot of outdoor skills training, you know, the waters are left out. But, you know, we live on a beautiful river. We're not too far from the ocean here. But also the one thing that we think about in terms of the Mariners Guild is also an understanding of economy. And I think that's what a lot of communities and schools miss out on when they're teaching about outdoor education is how do you actually develop reciprocal relationships of, you know, right livelihood or good livelihood that are pragmatic and real, that give people alternatives to simply just monetary earning, right? They give them options to create functional relationships that regenerate over time, that are about making a living, because you got to feed old people and babies. That's right. At the center of community, period. You can't have community unless you're doing that. Otherwise, you're just throwing a party or a potluck.
And those are fun, but they don't serve every need.
You know, eventually everyone goes and gets jobs and does something, especially when they start having kids.
Right.
And then the next one, the last one, is the Artisans Guild, which is really relevant because it actually is the role-playing game. It's like the dungeon master, so to speak, that, you know, they run the game. And, you know, we have a saying at Trackers that it doesn't matter whether a legend or myth is true or not. You best pay attention to the results it gets.
Ah.
So it really, you know, we do what we do because we believe it's the right thing to do. Sometimes there's no logic behind it. And so really it is about the stories we share that cause us to continue to make the choices we make.
Mm-hmm.
So if you create a different story or a different mythology, then people dramatically start to make different choices.
Like the story that you tell and the story that you hang on to influences your value system and what it is that you do. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the story is like, oh, it's way more efficient to get around in a car. Not necessarily all the time. You know, so if you have if you start to build a different story and you make that story compelling, you know, all the elements of a compelling story are there. Forget about logic. That's not necessary. You know, it's about we humans are driven by a compelling story, a zeitgeist that we share around the campfire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we like campfires. We've spent a good couple of nights around those, I think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way to look at story and look at narrative, because if you apply those same sort of principles to, like, say, a political campaign, I mean, logic and stats, I mean, kind of there, but it's emotional driven. It's a lot of times fear based, but right. it's mobilizing people through their emotions, as opposed to like, hey, this is a really good idea and this is more efficient, and I will show you the numbers as to why it's more efficient. People don't respond to that. Yeah, people respond to the emotive side of the story.
They don't. Yeah, and a good storyteller, I think also an ethical storyteller, or in this context, you could say an ethical educator, will craft and create stories that are pragmatic for the community, the culture, and the places they live. That's the key, you know. So people can abuse storytelling, and it happens in our culture all the time. In fact, our culture hinges on that kind of degradation of storytelling, that manipulation of storytelling. And so you have to understand those components of what makes a good story if you're going to sway people to a healthier, more pragmatic direction.
Mm-hmm. So how are you doing that with the people that you're working with?
Well, you know, primarily, for the most part, it is with kids. So we focus on working with kids. I would say last year, our first year in operation in 2004, we actually served, I think, 40 kids in our program. This past year in 2013, we served 8,000 during the summer alone.
Holy shit.
And then this next summer, we'll serve 12,000. You know, and a lot of that is based on just, you know, parents referring other parents to our program.
Right. Which is actually, I think, how I heard about you guys initially, is because one of our friends said, oh, there's this group called Trackers. They're doing cool things. A lot of word of mouth.
Yeah. And I think that's the most important thing, is if what you're doing is relevant to people. You know, it's not creatively indulgent. It's creatively relevant. That we draw that dichotomy often with, you know, in our staff and in our programs. You know, we always want to come up with something that's creatively relevant for people. Then they'll go there. Mm-hmm. They'll show up. And so it's all about, not about necessarily just the skills you teach, but that's important. It's also about the relationships that you build. And so, for instance, we have our camps where our campers come for 1 week. We have our adult programs where they'll come for a weekend. But, you know, my favorite kind of programs are the ongoing ones, where from there somebody says, you know, I really like this way of life. I really like this role-playing game. I say that with a wink and a nod that you have, right? And so I can join that community for a longer period of time. And for our adults, they'll come for 1 week in a month in what we call our village immersion program. For, you know, teenagers or kids, they'll come for a 1 week in a month in our Rangers Apprenticeship or Wilders Apprenticeship program. And that's where the real, like, ninja training takes place.
Yeah.
Especially in our Rangers program. And there is where I get an opportunity to see, you know, a teenager or teenagers, you know, kind of form this crew or team, this group of people that they can rely on, and some pretty phenomenal, like, escapades of, like, human ability, you know, where they're following an elk herd for hours on end, you know, and they're learning some pretty incredible strategies just from their footprints and maybe even from watching or seeing them or observing them. And, you know, you apply those same strategies to your interactions, your social interactions in a grocery store, at school, or at work. And you get some pretty mind-blowing experiences.
You start noticing
the herd of a different kind.
Yeah. There's strategies of awareness and strategies of flow and strategies also of kind of identifying what is that lie that we might lead in our culture today. Or what are some of the lies that we might lead in that culture today? You're seeing through the haze and the patterns too.
Mm-hmm. Right on. You keep coming back to the idea of relationship, and I think this is a really good and I think throughout all of time a very relevant idea. And that trackers is not just, you know, going out into the woods and learning your knots and learning how to read a compass or whatever. You know, this is learning how to build communities within this sort of fantasy world, would you say? Or?
Yeah, again, role-playing game, right?
Right.
I say that with a wink and a nod. It's, you know, some people definitely like really, this is where they find their community. But the relationships are really important. And I'll use an example actually in tracking itself where I have three different bears that I'll take my son out to go track every once in a while when I get a spare moment, you know, and I'm not staring at the computer, ironically enough, my 3-year-old son. And, you know, he'll start out walking with me, then I'll end up on my shoulders. And, you know, when we actually find, you know, the fresher sign, we'll start to talk about who it is. You know, and we're not talking about, hey, it's a black bear. And he's not there to become a master tracker of bears.
But you've personified these bears.
Well, they've personified themselves. They do individual things. You know, they are individuals. And they're individuals, and they have very specific relationships with the cougar. They have very specific relationships with each other. They have very specific relationships with us, right? How they look at us. And when we move through the woods, they hear us coming before they actually hear our footsteps or hear our voices. They hear us through the birds, right? You know, and I'm working with my son on building relationships with the birds so the birds don't alarm for him and us, so that one day maybe we will see that bear together or one of those bears. And
they're like the gatekeepers or the doormen of the woods.
They're
maybe
totally the sentries, man. And unless you're respecting the law of the jungle.
Right.
Right. If you stare right at them, they're going to give, you know, the call of hell and damnation is coming down the path.
Right, right.
And it kind of carries.
The humans are here.
Exactly. And it carries from one bird to another, right? Uh-huh. So it's not just like, you know, the bear hears the robin that's, you know, flying off the ground from foraging back up in the trees as you're, you know, walking through the field. It hears the towhee that heard the winter wren that heard the robin, right?
Right.
So you're kind of screwed no matter what.
Right on down the line.
Exactly. And so it's that like you got to pay your respects. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to know how to pay your respects. And it's not about just words, and it's not about just saying, oh, I'm sorry, or please don't do this. It's about actually the results you get. Mm-hmm. Right. And so and from there, it's about knowing the individuals, because if you just kind of throw this blanket theory onto what bears are, then you're missing what's actually there. You know, I often talk about how you'll see people walking through the woods, and it's, you ever seen Karate Kid?
Sure.
That costume we wore, you know, the shower curtain.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so imagine, like, they're wearing that shower curtain, and they got the scene painted of this scene of the forest painted on the inside. That's what they're seeing. They're just seeing, like, the scene of the forest that they all expect to see versus what's actually there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're describing a more active approach to hiking through the woods as right. opposed to, yeah, just walking through and following this trail and then getting to the end or, you know, watching it shoehorn itself back to your parking spot, so to speak.
Exactly, because those individual deer have individual habits. Those individual bear have individual habits. You're making a bow, and that piece yeah. of wood that you harvested has knots, and, you know, with and a unique grain, and you got to find the bow, and you got to work with the knots and let them be there.
I was just amusing myself thinking of like a stand-up comedy routine where, you know, bears do this and cougars do that. So, yeah, but I love this idea that, yeah, you're getting some sort of individuality and not just like the species of the animal that you're around or that you're nearby in the woods, but that, yeah, each one has its own characteristics.
Yeah. They're personable. And it's also that those characteristics exist in relationship with the rest of the forest. Mm-hmm. And that's really critical because actually I have people map a lot. And when they try to map individual data points, you know, when they say, this is where we found the bear track and this is where the alders are, they actually don't remember as much, but it's almost a very simple mnemonic device to actually map via relationships. This is the interaction of these entities, these people, these animals, this vegetation, this ecotone, this habitat, and hell, we could do it in our everyday lives when we're thinking about the strategy of our relationships. These are their interactions. And the way you approach the world changes dramatically when you focus on an awareness of relationships and not an awareness of individuals, which is very interesting because, you know, often in progressive education, we're taught to think everyone, you know, that we're special.
Right.
And
right.
Who gives a damn about that? That's boring. I want to see how you interact with people. I want to see your metal.
Right.
And that's way more fun, and it gives you more character.
And if those situations don't happen naturally, then you have to LARP.
Exactly. That's why LARPing is pretty epic, because you do have to interact. Now, again, there's this whole idea that you're LARPing to like achieve like total nerd dominance. But the reality is I think the best role-playing games are ones that are more egalitarian. They're not about winning, but they're about contribution.
Cooperative sort of exercises.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think my wife had a board game called Save the Whales that was a cooperative board game back in the day. And instead of playing against all your teammates, you would, I guess.
Oh, you play against the board.
You would play against the whalers, yeah. And against the deck and that sort of thing.
There's a couple of games like that. Yeah. Shadows of Camelot was one I used to play.
Yeah,
it's kind of the game is stacked against you.
Right, right. And so, yeah, this is the shift that you're talking about, Tony. It's going from like we're all in competition with each other to how can we all make this work and how can we all get what we need out of this situation.
Well, and that's a mythological, you know, shift too, because the myth in our society is kid goes to college, gets a great education, goes to college, leaves the nest, gets a great job.
That's a myth.
Saves up for retirement. Yeah, right. That's a total myth. You know, and that they're going to be like individually successful. They're going to fissure from their family, and that somehow they should move away to be successful. Mm-hmm. And the reality is it's like if you pool your resources, life is way more awesome, interesting, leisurely, and you get an opportunity to experience relationships more consistently. Mm-hmm. We're often always leaving because we're trying to win versus trying to collect and gather.
Right. And there's something to be said for establishing a network of people around you that's not going to change. And then when you know how those things evolve and how to read the patterns, you're going to be able to work more efficiently and more productively in that system.
Exactly. You know, okay. It's not about whether or not I can light a fire with no matches. It's about whether or not my community can get it done.
Sure.
And that then I, all of a sudden I got a fire, and that's the most important thing. Who cares how, you know, good I am at something?
Yeah.
That's boring.
Right. Right. Well, I guess that's also, I mean, in a way that's probably maybe the expresses really well the reason that I don't like professional racing and bicycling, because I love to bicycle. I love going out. But the myth is of Lance Armstrong that someday
the one
you
person
two,
that race. Conquered all.
You're look at how that myth turned out.
Jersey. Yeah, exactly. And you're going to have tons of dope in your blood. So, yeah, just the idea that For me, the things I love about the bicycling community are kind of what you're describing. It's a different context, I suppose, but the idea that some people wanted to have fun on bikes, they wanted streets that were safe for people to do that, and you know, people banded together, and various things happen. Now Velocult exists, for example. You know, that's here because somebody wanted it.
And the whole bike move phenomenon is a relationship oriented phenomenon.
Right.
I don't know if phenomenon is the right word for it, but it's relationship oriented. Yeah. You know, you can't, I mean, you could, I guess, bike move by yourself, but it's not going to be as.
It's what I did last time. It wasn't fun.
There you go.
But yeah, it's kind of the idea, like you're saying, like the myth is not of the lone victor. The myth is of the community rising together. So.
And exactly. There's an incredible amount of function behind that myth. So it is an ethical myth. It's an ethical storytelling. It's pragmatic too. You know, it passed that tests of it's useful to people. You know, not only does it get them around, but it gets them outside engaged and connected to each other. And I bet you there's ancillary benefits beyond biking, you know, with that community.
Right.
And I mean, that's critical. And actually, how pragmatic that has to be. If there was ever some sort of emergency state, or let's go back to the apocalypse, those folks are going to gel way more quickly and do necessary helpful things first and before anybody else will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know how to get around and network with each other.
The connections are there. And that, I'm thinking of Ethan Jewett, who
he's I know the, Ethan. He's great.
Right. He's with the Cascadian 55th, I believe. I'm trying to remember. And the disaster relief trials. But
yep.
He's one of the people that's he's thought through a lot of this apocalyptic scenario stuff and come up with some pretty good ideas. So, yeah.
He keeps on running those disaster relief trials when we're teaching summer camp. So,
oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I got to give him crap for that.
I'd be really intrigued to see how you two like were.
Oh, no. Actually, we the 55th Cascadia Scouts use our sites quite a bit, and we highly encourage their supreme awesomeness. I actually really appreciate them because it's a true collective of parents getting together and in a co-op fashion, giving their kids what they need and what they crave and doing it with their kids. You know, I would say if there's a challenge with trackers, you know, it's often without the parents there because that's what, you know, parents need is, you know, summer camps to send their kids to.
Yeah.
But I laud completely and support things like the 55th Cascadia Scouts because they are absolutely epic, and that's what's going to change the world.
Right. Yeah. And we still have to have them in. I think we're waiting until they do their trip out to Stubbs Stewart this year, which I think many of them are planning to do by bike. So we'll see.
Oh, yeah.
Sometime in May, I believe. But anyways. Yeah. So tell me how does it work out? Like you're talking about how this is a. Eventually, you hope this is kind of a family thing where people are doing it together across age boundaries. You're working primarily with groups of young people. Is that
we are, and yet at the same time, we're pushing more and more for family programs. So
okay.
We're going to have more overlap between our village immersion program and our apprenticeship program. And actually, the village immersion program is transformed into a program that has a focus on families coming.
Okay. So, and you mentioned this village. This is an actual village?
No, it's not an actual village setting. It does take place at our sites up in Sandy that we have a lot of restoration projects at, a lot of different skills projects happening. And that gathering will happen 1 week in a month, kind of like a giant family reunion.
Okay.
Where, you know, people will bring their kids, people will attend, you know, solo as adults. We'll have, you know, specific kids programs going on during that time, and all of our community and all of our staff will be there too. And it works on a very open space like principle where there will be an incredible array of things happening. So some people will actually go gather Wapato and transfer it to nursery beds for a restoration project on that specific land. Some people will go harvest bow staves and work on making their own bows. So that's more of a personal project. You know, there's some folks will actually start building a giant thatched hut that people can stay in. And so, and they get people and families get to choose where they go and what they participate in.
Challenge by choice.
Challenge by choice. Well, and learning by choice and collaborative learning too.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. And again, I think we may have talked about this before we started recording, but summer's a big time for you. A lot of people jump on at that point.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we're most known for as camps. Although I say that I would feel that those camps lead into programs that we call our ongoing mentoring programs, which is the 1 week and a month ones with the teens, kind of like our ninja club, so to speak, or our Rangers apprenticeship.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, we're doing what we call our Wilders apprenticeship, which is those kids that are more, kind of more homesteading oriented, animal husbandry, like, you know, 4-H squared, right? And so those things are what our staff often look forward to after summer. Summer is awesome. It's like this giant, you know, incredible celebration party where, you know, we do these incredible productions of camps that we plan for throughout the year. But then that quiet time, you know, for the rest of the year, fall through spring, is when we really work with the kids that want to take it further, and the adults too, that want to go further and more in depth and kind of become part of that community that we're creating.
Yeah. And part of that is an after-school program. Is that correct?
It is. It is. Our after-school program will be actually transforming quite a bit next year, where we'll focus more on specialized skills training for the after-school program, because interacting with picking kids up at school has always been you know, an interesting thing that we do really well at, but we want to focus more on having more time with kids outside. And so we're going to rely on actually more parents dropping off their kids after school and learning specific skill sets. So we actually have 2 or 3 hours outside versus like one.
Right. Yeah. Which is probably more useful the more time you have.
We really try to push it. We recently increased our camp hours an additional hour just to make sure that our day, we had another hour out of doors, so to speak. You know, and I'll be honest, one of the biggest challenges with our camps, period, is the fact that we're not going to be able to go across the street to the park across the street and do a lot of the skills that we want to train. You know, you can't do, for good reason, you can't do a campfire there. You can't go off trail there. Right?
Right, because it's a preservation area.
It's a preservation area. So we have to buy sites and cultivate those sites that are 40 to 45 minutes away, you know, via a bus, so the kids can do the skills that they're, you know, used to be able to do of their own accord 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so we're always looking for people that might have land that are that's nearby that would be appropriate for us to kind of set up a primitive camp.
Okay. And so there's the call, folks.
There's the call out.
Anywhere near Portland and you have land available.
And it's a good way to earn extra revenue. Trackers will contribute financially to the growth and sustaining that land.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing some stuff. Is there anything else you'd like to put in before we wrap up?
No, just actually, another shout out. Go check out the 55th Cascadia Scouts if you want to participate in a family way.
Right on.
You know, feel free to check out our summer camps if you want to, too. Although my goal is always to have people find what's best for their family. And I think that's always the focus.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it is Trackers...
TrackersEarth.org. TrackersEarth.com. And or you can go right to TrackersPDX.com, or you can go to TrackersBay.com, or you can go to your Eugene site, or you can go to... So we got a couple of options. Although we started in Portland, and we'll always be a Portland organization. Don't tell the Bay staff.
It gets political.
It's funny, actually. It's great because we're based in Berkeley and Oakland, so we all got a lot, you know, akin... And in common, and I appreciate seeing how the different cultures evolve.
Right.
It really is a culture, and the different role playing games evolve. And you know, their role playing game, so to speak, is unique to that area, just as ours is. And so to see them interact, it's fascinating.
Definitely, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although we got a lot in common with Oakland, it works well.
Did you scout when you were a kid?
No, I didn't actually. I was very anti-camp. I hated camp.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I couldn't stand it is because, you know, they came across as very, like, Snoopy camp. You know, and
like macaroni
on plates. And I was
resort
like, Jesus, this is boring, man. I just want to be a Jedi. Seriously, somebody figure that shit out. And no one did, so we're trying to figure it out.
Okay. Excellent. TrackersEarth.com. Tony Dias, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen, for having me.
Back.
And we're we're back, and I'm opening up a can of mango steam juice.
Oh, I thought that was—I thought it was Whoopass.
It is not. I'm all out of those cans.
Oh, okay, easy enough.
I should have rationed myself a little bit.
Yeah, well,
more.
You know, brand goes away. Brand goes away.
Yep.
Yeah. So hey, how about some news?
Let's do some news.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. It circles around the city lights.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight. Pedal just as fast.
From How We Roll, new covered bike parking improves transit access in Forest Grove. If you live, work, or study just a little too far away from the bus stop or train station to walk, biking to transit is a great option to consider. If there's room, you can bring your bike with you on board, but often demand is high and bike parking comes to the rescue. Parking your bike at the stop or station allows you to complete the rest of your trip on transit hassle-free without always watching after or worrying about your bike. We're very happy to highlight the City of Forest Grove's efforts in providing high-quality covered bike parking at three locations along Line 57 TV Highway, Forest Grove, in Forest Grove.
Yeah, yeah, this is super cool because...
You got some pictures of that.
Yeah, yeah. Too. Oftentimes, it's not hard to find a place to lock your bike to, either a sanctioned bike rack or, you know, some other metal implement or piece of something that you can lock your bike frame to while you're away. But it's really nice when they are also covered. And it reminds me of here near where I live on Hawthorne Boulevard, there's the Bike Oasis. I believe there's one of those in Sandy near Velocult as well, where they've built
Hawthorne
kind of a little...
Hawthorne in like, what, like 34?
It's right next to the Bank of America.
Okay.
Oh, okay. 37th or 8th, somewhere in there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice amenity because any place you live that has rain and precipitation, it's good to have something to keep your bike dry. And you can leave your bike outside in the wet all day, but it's best if you don't.
Yeah.
Just for wear and tear.
Yeah. I'm always worried about being too far away from my bike.
Yeah.
Even if it's locked, I get like, I don't know, I just have this sort of bike nervousness.
Right. Well, and it reminds me again of losing my saddle, which is the reason that I now carry a kryptonite cable. And I, you know, I attach the rails of the saddle to the rest of my bike using the cable.
Right.
So I overlock whenever I lock, if there is such a thing.
From the Urban Adventure League, Sean gives a rundown on traveling with a bike. In short, if you need to use a plane and are willing to part with your bike for a period of time, Amtrak's freight service can get your bike where you need it to go more cheaply than if you pay for an airline fee to bring it on the plane with you.
Yeah, and his particular situation was actually getting to and from San Francisco. He only had, like 3 days to do it or something like that. It was a really short trip, short visit. He wanted to have a bike. And so he references Amtrak Freight, which is a fantastic way. That's how Adele and I got our bikes back from California at the end of our West Coast tour, because we were flying to the East Coast after that. And Amtrak Freight, I believe you put it on the train, it shows up at your destination. And if you're going to be there, as Sean was, you can just go down and pick it up. All that you need for this to work is not to need your bike for a couple of days, something like that. So, yeah, it works out nicely.
And that's our news.
And those are our headlines. Mangosteen is the drink you're drinking.
Is this fruit in which I'm drinking the juice of? In which of I am drinking the juice? Wait.
Conjugate carefully, sir.
The fruit in which is being juiced and therefore being produced for my consumption. Anyways, Mangosteen. There was this multi-level, you know, pyramid scheme.
Oh.
Multi-level marketing scheme.
Like Amway?
Yes, much along those lines. Specifically around pure mangosteen juice and marketing it and like all of the sort of health benefits that come from that.
Yeah.
Mangosteen has very little nutritional value.
Oh, okay, well, that's good to know. It's like the celery of the fruit world.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay,
it tastes great.
Yes, yeah.
Hence I'm drinking it.
Right, right. I am not aware of mangosteen's existence. I know of mangoes, but this is different.
I can't remember where if it's a Malaysian fruit or what.
Is it a pitted
where it
fruit?
Originally came from. I don't know.
Looks like it has four pits by the graphic.
No, that's the fruit. The rind is the purple stuff.
Oh, I see. And the rind is inedible.
Yes.
It's like a banana peel.
Without the peeling mechanism that a banana would have.
Okay. Nice.
We should research this more.
Yes, this episode brought to you by Mangosteen Juice.
Get it at your local Asian grocery store.
That's it, yeah. Is it right next to the pickled ginger? Because pickled ginger, that's some good stuff.
Small amounts for me.
Okay.
I can't have
yeah.
too much.
Well, yeah, it's a palate cleanser, right?
Yes.
That's how it's intended?
Yes.
But you can also just eat it like crazy.
But also, it's delicious.
All right. How about some mail?
Why not?
We got mail. Hey, we got mail.
Newest sustaining donors, Wayne and Roger, join up. Roger invites us also to drop in when we bike through Santa Cruz, which we
just mentioned. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Wayne and Roger.
Yeah.
Former guest Guthrie Straw says that the bike shop equivalent of Stairway to Heaven is Bicycle Race by Queen.
And I'll make a point of pride that song has never been played or referenced on this show until now.
Oh, holy shit.
Yeah. No, it's... I think I saw that song as being overdone.
Of course.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Which he says in the lengthier version of that email, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely. To the point where it's just unlistenable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't the music video for that basically a World Naked Bike Ride? I thought...
I don't remember the video for
okay.
that.
Okay. I could be wrong.
Honestly.
I thought it was a bunch of naked people on bikes.
I know it's just about every year, right? The film by bike gets a submission for a video of a song.
You know, I hadn't heard about this, but I would assume so.
Oh yeah,
and that's probably like immediate grounds for disqualification for any video.
Maybe
I'm sure they feel similar to me.
Straight into the circular. Form.
Right, right, and not that it's a terrible song. And for a long time, it was like the only pop culture reference you could make about a bicycle. But there are so many others. So, anyways, and actually, I was. I do appreciate the response. When I asked the question, what's the bicycle shop equivalent to Stairway? I was kind of wondering, like,
we weren't
what is it
necessarily talking about a song.
Well, though. What is it that people do when they go into a
right,
bike shop? That
exactly.
would be like someone walking into a guitar store, picking up a guitar and playing Stairway to Heaven.
Right.
So I was guessing maybe like, I don't know, like testing the spokes or...
like doing the whole like...
Yeah. Or something like that. Or maybe it's as simple as just like spinning the pedals, the freewheel backward or something.
Yeah.
Anyways, if you have ideas about that, I'm still curious. But yes, thank you, Guthrie, for the bicycle race.
I kind of want to play it.
Don't you dare. We don't have the licensing.
I don't have it. I don't have it anyways. Bicycle Film Festival, Portland happens Saturday, March 15th at 6:30. At the Clinton Street Theater.
Yeah, and strangely, we were unaware of this, even though apparently...
Yeah, it like flew under our radar, and it's a national thing.
Yeah,
right?
It's been around for, since 2001, I believe.
Yeah.
And, so apparently, as well as Film by Bike, which I was on the jury for this year, I highly endorse that event. Also, the Bicycle Film Festival is happening in Portland,
Also at the Clinton Street Theater.
Yes, yeah, so it would be easy to confuse the two, except one is a month earlier. So if you want to get your fill of bicycle film, you can come and see those.
You could just spend a month at the Clinton Street Theater.
Totally, and they would show really good things. You would see the Rocky Horror Picture Show four times, I think, if you spent a month there. So,
I still yet to do that. I really want to go do that.
Right. It's a big thing. And again, I believe the Clinton Street Theater has the longest running, continuously showing, like a weekly showing of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So, yeah.
Next, Keith in Walla Walla approves... I wanted to thank you for having Thunder Island Brewing on your podcast a couple of weeks ago. We drove over from Walla Walla on Valentine's weekend and took a tour of their brewery. Great folks and excellent beer. Dan and Dave do a great job making you feel right at home.
Yeah.
P.S. Remember when you go through Walla Walla this summer on your bike trip, you have a place to stay.
Right. So that's the other one is that, for June, we're going to ride to Missoula.
Yes.
And so,
for the summer, you and yours are going all the way across.
That's true. Adele and I are hoping to make it to Boston. Or if we don't make it to Boston, I was really inspired by Matt Piccio's thing when he finished up his continental tour because he didn't make it all the way to the coast. And a lot of people were like, oh, are you disappointed? Are you bummed that you didn't make it all the way? And he was like, hell no, I had a great time.
Yeah.
I did everything I wanted to do. And that's why I came home, is because I was like, if I keep riding, it's just going to be riding. It's going to suck. And I'm not going to like it anymore. So I did everything I wanted to do when I went out to take a big long trip.
Oh,
and I think that's kind of informed, because I would probably be suspect. How do you say that? I would fall prey to the idea that if I did not make it all the way to Boston by bike, I would have somehow failed.
Right.
And so I'm trying really hard to see it as like, you know, we have this much time. We're going to go out and ride. And if we have a good time, that's the win.
And if you get sidetracked along the way.
Totally. You know? Yeah. Like if we try to go to Ragbri. Or I also found out one of my favorite bands, Eve Six, is touring with Everclear on a national tour.
No way.
Yeah. We're going to be out of town when they come to Portland, but maybe.
But maybe, just maybe.
Maybe they'd be in a city near where we're traveling across the north part of the U.S.
If you happen to be in Madison at the time that they are.
Right, right. Or somewhere in Ohio. So we'll see what happens. I'm not banking on that one, but yeah.
No, I'm not banking on them being in Ohio at all.
Yeah, or you're probably not banking on Everclear or Eve Six.
No, yeah. Certainly not.
I'm a fan of the late 90s rock, so call me old. Call me old.
Okay, you're old.
Thanks.
Next, Johnny K. Would it be possible to post a link to the X-Ray FM version of the show for those of us who are not within range to hear it over the air?
Yes, of course, and I'll put the link up there. Sure. Right now, I believe the online stream is still in beta. At some point soon, the X-Ray, if you just type in X-Ray FM, well, X-Ray.fm, into your web browser, you'll land on a page where you can listen to it immediately. Right now, the beta stream is there, and I believe you said you heard them on the air earlier today?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. They are, I believe they are broadcasting to the Portland area.
I was near Gateway at the time.
Okay,
so it was
right.
A little bit closer.
Closer to the transmitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and apparently we tried earlier. I live right in the shadow of Mount Tabor, so I can't get that station at all.
Not yet.
Which is why we do the show here, in seclusion, away from the
airwaves. Who was I talking to? Someone was like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to listen to you guys on the radio. And I said, I suggest you listen to the unedited version first.
Right, well, it depends on what you're doing, because I would assume a lot of people...
already, you know, if you're listening to the radio anyways, like some people have jobs.
Right. Some people have things to do with their time.
Some people have jobs.
No, but the thing about the X-ray feed is that if you're listening at work and perhaps you live or work in a place where profanity is anathema.
Or just frowned upon.
Yeah. And our show, of course, is not necessarily safe for work if you're playing it through speakers. So the radio version will be enough for the kids, I guess, or something like that. Yeah. It will at least all the dirty words will be censored out. And so there will even be, as I understand, a podcast feed of that version of the show at some point. So this is good for a certain context. And if you like the swears and you want to hear us be relentlessly profane, we can do that for you as well.
Hell's
We're a full service shop. Yeah.
Next, Drew corrects Brock.
Yes, he did.
Just enjoyed your latest podcast. I'm hoping Gladys Bikes has the new Brooks Cambium saddle I can try.
And what was the word on that? I thought that she was working on getting some in.
I don't want to misquote her.
I could be wrong. Leah Benson of Gladys Bikes might have a Cambium saddle at some point. That's the vegan Brooks saddle.
Yeah. I know we've talked about riding it.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't go in there and tell her we said so.
No.
Yeah.
You can turn off the dynamo hub light by sliding the black ring on it using the tab. No need to use a sock.
All right. I am chagrined. I feel sheepish. I know how my equipment works. Thank you. Thank you, Drew.
You will have a great time on your ride down the California coast. The last time I did it was a few years ago, and I put a post on Crazy Guy on a Bike.
CrazyGuyOnABike.com, which is a great compendium of tour journals and other things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I believe this is the one he did on his homemade folding bike. So if you want to see some cool pictures of a bike that he built, I think there's probably at least one there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Drew.
Jamie shares a story about failed flirtation on light rail.
No, this is good.
Yeah. I overheard this one on BART, and BART is the Bay Area something transit.
Yeah, down in the Bay Area. Right. Yes.
I can't remember what the R
is. Bay Area Regional Transit is regional, my guess, but I'm not from there, so I don't know.
Okay.
Bojan would know. So would Jamie.
For context, if you get on BART in Oakland during the AM commute, you are not going to get a seat. It is pretty much a given. There was a woman standing up in the BART car in her professional attire, skirt, heels, leaning against the wall, engrossed in her smartphone. A guy about her age is sitting down and starts to engage in a little flirty conversation. After a few sentences, he offers her his seat. She replies with something like, "That's funny, I've seen you on the train dozens of times over the past few months, and you haven't offered me a seat before."
Oh.
He kept digging his hole and said, "Oh, sorry for not offering sooner." And then she goes back to her smartphone. Meanwhile, everyone on the train is abuzz with laughter and thinking,
Oh, snap.
It was pretty hilarious.
That's fantastic. So
I might have said that out loud if I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh!
Holy shit, trademark.
That's right.
Yeah. It would be... probably, I guess the lesson, the takeaway from this is if you see someone attractive on public transit and you want to give them your seat, do it immediately.
Yes.
Don't wait.
Well, and don't use, I don't know, etiquette? No. What am I trying to say? Don't be a nice guy just because you think you could get into somebody's pants.
Right. Don't use chivalry as a lever.
Thank you. Chivalry was the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Seriously. Chivalry is good enough on its own. And it makes a terrible lever.
Yeah, no. You want something like iron or, you know,
right.
Wood would be okay, I guess, in some occasions.
Cambium?
But,
no.
No, not
it's
so
probably
much.
More for like a sling or a strap or something.
You can rest things on it.
Yes. Well, hey, good show. Should we close her down?
Sure.
All right.
I mean, I'm all for closing this down. I'm just not ready.
They're playing the Semisonic song over the speakers, and you're not ready to go home.
Oh, no.
You want to stay here.
No, don't reference that.
Did I tell you that my friend's wedding, I don't know, I may have mentioned that on the show.
No, tell me that wasn't the last song.
The song they walked down the aisle to after being married was Closing Time.
What?
Which surprised even me, because he's like too hip for that, I would think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was it supposed to be like kind of ironic and funny?
Oh, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is the wedding where the guy, like, the ring bearers had men in bear costumes carrying them.
So, right. Yeah. Ring bears.
Exactly. There was actually, what was it? There was Mr. Rogers' Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the classic children's show.
Oh, the big purple imaginary panda thing?
Is that it?
Yeah, I can't remember what his name was.
Well, there was, you know, there was make-believe, the land of make-believe, where the trolley would go from Mr. Rogers' house to the land of make-believe every week.
Yeah, and Daniel the Striped Tiger.
Yes, yeah. And it might have been Daniel, because he was the one that was kind of like nervous and reticent. He was like the piglet of that world.
Yeah.
And as I recall, he was supposed to be a part of a wedding, and he was supposed to be the ring bearer, but he said, "I don't want to do it. I don't want to wear the costume." And character is like, "What costume?" He's like, "The bear costume."
Nuh-uh.
And they had to like educate him that no, it's a ring bearer, not a ring bear. And then
so
he was
funny.
Okay with it. I don't remember who was getting wedding or married at all. Cultural references for the win.
I really hope someone writes us back. Someone writes to us and be like, you know, it was Lady Aberlin and
well, that's
you know,
my
Prince.
Guess.
Whatever.
Right, exactly, yeah. Wait, were they... They were the human characters, and then the puppet characters were King and Queen.
Yeah.
Were they related?
King Friday,
were they supposed
the
13th, to be related?
By the way. And Queen... I can't remember the Queen's name.
Yeah. Tuesday?
No. No, I can't remember.
Thursday? Those are the feminine
sounding
names.
I don't think it's a day
oh, okay.
of the week. Maybe right. it is.
I forget.
I'm in total blank right now.
All right.
All right, now I'm ready.
Bam.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics or guests. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. You can also text us to that number. Connect with us on Twitter at sprocketpodcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Thanks to Hurt Bird for our headline sounder. And thanks again to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, Katharina Melamgard, Roger Grisby, and Wayne Norman. Thank you all so much.
Definitely. You guys are the best.
Brush your teeth.
Go to bed.
anachronism?
That's an anachronism.
Is it an anachronism? Well, yeah.
I taped over something?
Something out of time. Yeah.
No, I just pushed some ones and zeros to a different part of the hard drive, which would eventually be erased. They were pushed into the dustpan.
I don't know where this Westernware store is that I was thinking of.
Is it near the Max? Or is it farther out?
Oh my god.
I still have some wacky FM DJ in me.
That's right.
The amount of that we did back in the early days of the show is ridiculous. Like, in comparison.
Yeah. Script card. Okay, I got it.
It's a callback for longtime listeners.
Dan Christensen.
Yeah, yeah. No, I want to get him back.
We should.
Because it's been too long. And I was thinking if we got him and Dr. Jeff in the same room, that'd be a fun show.
Yes, it would.
Yeah. So that's my idea.
We wouldn't have to do anything.
No, we just set it up. Be like, here are the pins. Please, knock them down. Yeah. And then they would just knock down pins. They would bowl strikes for 10 frames. A Sprocket Studios production.